Now I invite our speaker tonight, Malcolm Shrimpton, to come forward and deliver his talk, Does Religion Cause War?
In the local paper this past week, there were a couple of rather interesting little items. One was about a piece of art that had been sold from Vancouver and was on its way to Calgary. And there was a picture of this artwork in another part of the newspaper. The artwork was a skeleton outline of a church. It was obviously a church because it had a steeple. But quite interestingly, the steeple was pointed down into the ground and the body of the church was up in the air. Now, this is modern art. And for those of you who have dealt with modern artists, you realize that more often than not, they feel that the job of an artist in today's society is to make a social comment. And so the question that we have for everybody here this evening is, what is the social comment made by someone who turns a church upside down and portrays it that way? Well, it's not a very flattering image of religion in general, is it? Now, there was another rather interesting little point, and it was buried in the bowels of the newspaper, and the caption read, Man Killed in Religious War. Well, there was about that much column, two columns wide in the newspaper on this topic. Maybe some of you read it. What it was a dispute about land between a group of people who were living near a Coptic church. And the church was building something, and the local Muslims, the local farmers, objected to this church structure. And the discourse got so severe that finally shots were fired and someone was killed. Well, was it really a religious war? That's the question. Or was it a dispute about land that happened to be between two people with different faiths? What do both of these things illustrate? They illustrate that we live in a world where there's not a very flattering picture of our Bible on the one hand and of religion on the other. And if you look at school curricula and other teachings, university coursework structures and so forth, you realize that modern social teaching is very much against the basis for the Bible. And it's almost taken as a truism nowadays that many of the problems in our society are caused by particularly the Christian religion. Many of the wars and disputes that we have been caused because of Christian beliefs. It's a truism in today's world. Another truism in today's world is that the Bible has been responsible for almost all the environmental degradation that we see in our Western society particularly. This despite the fact that the law of Moses has prohibitions against the cutting of trees, has regulations to preserve wildlife, and even such obscure wildlife as vultures are protected under the law of Moses. And these are all very modern thoughts, very modern ideas, and yet nobody recognizes that they're part of a very ancient teaching in the Bible. And the Bible is credited with destroying the world instead of preserving it as the intention was under Moses. Slavery is considered to be a product of Christian teaching. The Bible is blamed for the onset of slavery, particularly in Western societies through the 1700s. This despite the fact that there were very sincere and hard-working Christians who built the Underground Railway to free slaves. And despite the fact that many sincere and hard-working Christians worked very hard in the British Parliament to abolish slavery. Nowadays, the current perception is not that they were the Christians who stood against slavery, but rather that it was finally economics which destroyed the slave movement. And so even when Christians work for something which is socially acceptable, they don't get credit for it. So when we have a title like tonight's "Does Religion Cause War?" then the answer in almost everybody outside these walls at any rate is absolutely. There's no question about it. Almost all the problems in our society have been caused because of beliefs, particularly Christian beliefs. Well, what does that little first verse that we read tonight mean then? From in the words in translation, which I have here, "From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even from your own lusts that war in your members? Ye lust and have not, ye kill," and probably the better translation of that word "kill" is the word "murder," which was read in the translation we have on the platform. Well, no. Not even the Bible commentators think that. At the heading of the marginal references in the Bible, which I have, it says that this verse talks about covetousness. And the little numbers which are there in the margin of my Bible, the word "kill," has got a little number beside it. And when I look in the marginal reference there for that little number, the word which is offered is envy. And indeed, when we look at James, and we will in a few minutes, when we look at James, there is something to be said for that particular point of view. So this evening, now that we've sort of set the stage that indeed nowadays almost everyone outside buildings like this see that Christianity as a problem-causing factor within today's society, and that many people who look at their Bible don't take the words at face value, but place other values upon them. So what then is the answer? Does religion cause wars? I want to do three things this evening. I want to look quickly and just scan the whole of this epistle of James very, very fast and see what James is talking about. Start in the first chapter and just zip right through till the end. After we've done that, I want to go back over history with you a little bit. And we'll ask the question of all these different things which have happened within our lifetime and before, have they been caused by Christianity? What about the Boer War, for instance? And I raise that one because my grandfather was in the Boer War. And when I was a little lad, I used to visit my grandfather, and he was a postmaster for the British Army in South Africa. So, and he had picked up in the course of his career as a postmaster all kinds of stamps. And I, as a young fellow interested in postage stamps, used to have a great time looking at these bits of paper that my granddad had collected throughout his lifetime. And we used to talk about stamps and the post office and things like that. And I had a post office savings bank and those other things that go along with it. But we didn't talk about the Boer War. He didn't want to talk about the Boer War. I wonder why my grandfather just left that page behind him, picked up the bits that were of interest to him out of that phase of his life, and left the rest behind. I wonder why. Did religion cause that war? Did religion cause any of the wars that we've seen recently? And then after we have looked at that in our second part of our talk, a couple of places where there are words in the Old Testament that we associate with warfare, I'd like to look at them with you and see if the Bible does indeed offer us an alternative to this concept that we all have in our minds, that sooner or later we're going to fight over something. And the idea which is in so many people's minds, that Christianity has been the thing which has caused people to go to war more often than not. Well, if you look at the beginning of James, it just so happens that at the top of the second page, right at the top left-hand corner, there's a very interesting little word, two words. The word's double-minded. And what does it mean by being double-minded? The word is actually also in the fourth chapter, which was read to us this evening. It occurs twice in James, this little phrase, double-minded. What does he mean? Does he mean that this person can't make up their mind about things? Does he mean that whoever is there is sort of tries to skate between two ideas and doesn't want to be seen to be upholding one idea more than another? Do they try to give the impression that they have two things that they're supporting, quite distinct things at the same time? Does it mean that they say one thing and mean another? What does James mean by this little word here, double-minded? And now that I put that idea in your mind, what does the whole idea of having a split personality almost, having been double-minded about something, what does that have to do with tonight's topic? When we're talking about the generation of wars and whether it is a Christian belief which has started these conflicts within human society. Well, look at the first few verses in James. The verses which come lead up to that verse which contains the word double-minded. It's in the eighth verse of the first chapter. If you look in the second verse, it says, "Count it all joy, knowing this, when your faith worketh patience, and patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire. If you lack wisdom, ask of God, but ask in faith. Now we have a whole series there of worthwhile human attributes listed. And where indication is that we can obtain these worthwhile human attributes by asking for God's wisdom, that they flow naturally out of looking for something that God offers us. And if after doing that, then, we should build our faith in God and in what God has given us as a series of human attributes because of the belief that we have. So maybe the double-minded man is somebody who only has part of that, who seems to have it and yet doesn't really. And surely that is more probably what James means when he gets toward the end of the chapter. If any man among you seem to be religious, but be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, James says in the 22nd verse of that first chapter. So James is playing off the idea of appearing to be one thing, of saying one thing, but not carrying out what you've been saying, or maybe even meaning it, but not doing it. And that's the idea which is there in that 22nd verse. So then James concludes his first chapter this way: pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. Now, I would suggest to you that keeping oneself unspotted from the world is in picking up those attributes which we have there in the first three or four verses of James. But that having picked up those attributes, it's then necessary to do something with them. And that's the point which is here in this verse. But, said James, or you turn over the page, but, said James, don't be partial. Don't be judgmental. Don't choose you're going to go here because you can get so much more credit for it than over there where you're not going to get so much credit. But if you fulfill the royal law in the eighth verse, and this is one of the things which is picked up all the time. When anybody, in fact, the Supreme Court in Saskatchewan picked up this point, when they were talking about it was a challenge on whether or not a person should be permitted to speak against homosexuality. And the judgment of the Supreme Court in Saskatchewan was no, you couldn't say things like that. What you had to do was this. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Everybody knows a couple of verses like that, even the Supreme Court judges in the province of Saskatchewan. But then we get to this little point towards the end of the second chapter. If anyone of you say unto somebody, well, yes, you need help, That's a summary of the 16th verse. Yes, you certainly need help. But you don't do anything about it. You failed, in so many words, is what James is saying here. If you don't do anything about it. And so the summary there of the whole chapter is that faith is shown in the works that we do. And now in the third chapter, we come to a very damaging little section. It's one thing to say, yes, I recognize that somebody needs help, and even to do it. But what we say and how we say things, even the intonation in our voice, can be very damning, even if we seem to be doing the right thing. James uses the image of a ship, a large ship. It's just a tiny little rudder which can move it and steer it and see it through stormy weather by pointing up into the wind and not losing your point. So you can ruin that whole thing. You can sink the ship. You can destroy a lot of things if you don't use your tongue properly. And that's an outgrowth, isn't it, of these first few verses that we looked at. The attributes, the patience, and so forth, which James talks about. If those things are shown in the way we speak, and what we say, and how we deliver on the things that we talk about, then we are indeed Christians, and are seen to be Christians. That's the point that James is making. We need to be seen to believe the things that we're saying. So then you come to this verse that we talked about in the beginning. From whence come wars? And so one can quite see that it's very easy, isn't it? With that lead-in, that we're looking at personal attributes, we're looking at personal improvement, we're looking at basing that personal improvement on God's word, and we're looking at delivering on the way we act and the way we are seen in society as believers in the Bible. It's easy then to say, well, obviously James isn't talking about real war. He's talking allegorically. What he's really talking about is what's going on in your mind, in your speech, in the things that transpire between you and your neighbors. Well, that's possible. Therefore, says James in the last verse of this fourth chapter, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. It's something which sets him aside from God. If you know what you're supposed to do, but you don't do it, then you are wrong. To put it very bluntly and very simply and in modern language. So go to now, you rich men, said James in the next chapter, talking about wealth, talking about all those things that we may feel we want, feel we need. Behold the hire of the people who have worked for you. You've lived in pleasure on the earth in the fifth verse. And then the whole matter turns in the seventh verse of this last chapter in James. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth and hath long patience for it until he receive the early and the latter rain. Be ye patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draws nigh. But above all things, my brethren, swear not. So, what have we got in this epistle? We've very obviously got a personal exhortation. We've very obviously got a straightforward reprimand to people who would say one thing and not carry through in it. We've got the statement, and a clear statement, that if you really are a Christian, the things that you do should mirror the things that you say, and both should be in line with the teachings of the Bible. And then we have this little phrase. Why have the word murder in the middle of it? Why put that word murder there? Why use the word war? Why speak about conflict in those terms? Because when one person does something, it may not be noticed by the majority. When two do it, a few more people will notice. Three, four, five, you've got a group. 100 or 1,000, you can have a riot or a peaceful demonstration, depending on what the group feeling, the group attitude, the group belief, and the group action on the basis of those beliefs is. There's a little note in, I believe it's in today's paper, about Che Guevara. Revolutionary. Started communist revolution Middle America. He was Argentinian by birth. And then there was Karl Marx writing in London. There weren't many of them, just a few. But they have started an enormous movement which has brought much damage on the earth. So you see, it's not merely what one person does that James is talking about. It's when these ideas grow in a population that either good things or bad things can come out of them. So what has happened within the last several years in our society? It's interesting to me that we look at the present Iraq war, and many of the commentators, the political commentators that talk about it, say, well, it's the work of the religious right. George Bush is so convinced, because he's part of the religious right, so convinced that he's correct, and that everything he does is right and proper, that he now believes he has the authority, the divine authority, some commentators will go so far as to say, to wage war on Iraq if it so suits him. And that's very interesting, because we do seem to have religious conflict in Iraq right now, don't we? There's certainly a very strong religious movement against the presence of the Americans. And not only that, what we have actually seen happen, and one very intelligent woman in Iraq pointed this out, that in a television article comment that we saw, she said what George Bush and the Americans have done is take a barely functioning secular state, and turn it into a completely non-functional religious state. And that seems to be what's happened in Iraq. But what are the American objectives there? The American objectives are to put democracy and the rule of law into Iraq. And so the question that we have to ask is democracy and the rule of law equivalent to religion? Because the force for that battle seems to be, one, to get back at people that hit America, and secondly, to put a form of government in there which will not give us problems in the future. That war is not trying to spread religion. Now, typically, we talk about the English-Irish thing and talk about religious differences there. Almost always when people raise this issue, they start with something like the Spanish Inquisition and move from there. Maybe they will raise the troubles that swept through Europe during the time of the Reformation and talk about them. But what I want to do right now is work backwards from the war in Iraq. We've raised the question that maybe that war isn't all about religion, and maybe the war in Afghanistan isn't entirely about religion either. What happened before that? When was the next most recent war that you can think of? Is it in somewhere in Indochina? Is it in the insurrection in Nepal? Is it in parts of India? Where is it? Well, most of the trouble that we have seen in the previous 40 years was almost entirely due to the spread of communism. Vietnam was, Korea was, all of the problems throughout French Indochina, Laos, Cambodia, and so forth, were all due to the movement to spread communism, which started really in the 1920s in that part of the world. So is communism a religion? And did the Western societies resist communism because of religious or commercial interests? And that question takes us right back to the end of the Second World War. And at the end of the Second World War, after the Americans had all gone home and everything seemed to be nice and quiet, the British were still fighting in places like Malaya and Singapore and in northern Greece and places like that. And they were fighting the spread of communism. Because communism, as it had started with a revolution in Russia in 1916, while this First World War was ongoing, was still spreading throughout Europe, throughout Central America, throughout Southeast Asia, and also into China. At the same time as this Greece was being liberated from the communists, Mao started his insurrection against the nationalist Chinese. Was that religious? Nobody even thinks of religion in that context. What about the First World War then? Certainly the Second World War was anything but religious. And the interesting thing is that there were people in this room who stood up for their religion and objected to war, objected to having to go to war during the Second World War. Why? Because their Christian beliefs insisted that they should not go to war to kill people. Again, you see, the Christian message was forgotten. First World War, space, over territory, to get rid of an abusive empire that had gradually degenerated and was gradually becoming far more exploitive than people could tolerate. And the interesting thing is that even though we started out and Woodrow Wilson got going in the Treaty of Versailles with the concept that people should have freedom, based on their own sort of set of internal values, ethnic ideas were very strong when the Treaty of Versailles started. In spite of all the high-minded talk, places like the Kurds throughout Turkey, Iraq, and Iran never got in. The Armenians were forgotten. Many nations were just discarded. All the trouble in the Balkans was left behind because of the failure of the Treaty of Versailles coming out of the Second World War, First World War. Religion was not part of that at all. There were ethnic concerns and territorial concerns and commercial concerns which started the war, and those same concerns cleared up things afterwards. And so to the Boer War, the one that I raised, and we're now back to about 1900. And so to the Boer War, the war that I raised at the beginning, that my granddad was part of at the Postal Service. Well, stories that come out of South Africa would indicate why he didn't particularly want to talk about it. It wasn't a happy time for anybody. But why did we fight over South Africa? What was there that people wanted? It's gold. We have South Africans in our midst, and they can tell you this. The gold that has come out of South Africa in these years since then has flooded the world. Quality of the diamonds that have come out of there have been second to none, and it's only very recently that people are finding diamonds outside South Africa. The wealth of that area was what people fought over, not the spread of religion. Religion is blamed somewhat because Stanley and Livingstone, of course, moved into the Central Africa, and they were there to preach and to convert and to teach, set up hospitals and all those things. But interestingly, the Christian missionaries are never given credit for any of those positive things. Rather, they are accused of bringing the armies in their tail and creating all told misery. And yet, if you really look at what people have taken and what people fought over, they were fighting over wealth. We're now into the 1800s, and one can argue that the Franco-Prussian concerns were about religion, because Prussia was Protestant and France was Catholic. But what we were really doing, and what most historians will argue about this whole period of history, what was really happening was that European boundaries were being established in the way, in the situation that we have now. They were adjusted slightly in the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the First World War, but by and large, the trouble in the 1800s set modern European boundaries. There were fights between Denmark and Sweden. There were fights between, as we mentioned, along the Polish border. And there were squabbles between, particularly between Prussia and France, and they occupied much of the ground. And on an international scale, France and England and Holland were fighting over trade routes throughout the Americas and through Southern Africa and through Southeast Asia. The spice trade was growing. Tea and spices. That was what they were fighting over. Two Protestant nations were fighting to gain the benefits from the tea and the spice trade, the English and the Dutch. Then when we get back into the 1700s, well, quite interestingly now, I suppose, we can start talking about religion. Because this is the era when the English brought in William of Orange, for instance, to colonize Ireland and turn Ireland into a Protestant enclave. Now, the word is that the Irish never forget and the English never remember from that conflict. But isn't it interesting that just yesterday, the Irish also threw somebody else out? They threw out the charter which the European Union had developed. They did this in a vote. The Irish are still doing exactly the same thing. They don't want to be brought into anybody else's enclave. It's not religion. It's independence. It's national identity. It's things like that that have driven those conflicts, even though the two sides may have differed in their religious point of view. You have to go back to the 1600s and to the Protestant Reformation to start seeing clear evidence of disputes on purely religious grounds. And interestingly, if you go back further than that, to the time of the Crusades, most people pick up the Crusades as being evidence of clear religious differences and religiously driven wars. What was also going on at the same time was that the trade routes which had been part of the Mediterranean, from the Byzantine Empire throughout the Mediterranean, had been destroyed by the Arabs when they spread the beliefs of Muhammad throughout that area. The Crusades were just as much about trying to reestablish those trade routes as they ever were about liberating Jerusalem, from the infidel, as they were called in those days. So, I would suggest to you that history doesn't really advance the notion that religion is responsible for the world's troubles. But what history does tend to do is indicate that religion has very often been implicated and has often been blamed, even though it may not have been the initial precipitating agent. So, in answer to our title, I would suggest that religion isn't the cause of wars. There are other causes, but religion is dragged along because people do have strong beliefs. I would suggest to you that the ideology is very often one of the reasons for this cause of disputes, communism and such like being a very strong idealistic set of beliefs. That has been spread with violence, there's no doubt about it. And I would suggest to you then that what we really need to do is look at the alternative view of what goes on and what the Bible says about things like this. We've said that out of James, we're left with the idea that we need to develop, based on biblical tenets, a set of personal standards, and we need to put those into action. And those personal standards have to govern our thoughts, our speech, and our actions. What I'd like to do now is pick up a word which is used and look at it in just two places in the Bible, the word violence. Violence is a word which we always associate with warfare. We always think of violent acts as being part of warfare. Well, what does the Bible mean when the Bible picks up this notion of violence? Well, one of the obvious places where the word is used, we're not going to look at it, just remind you of it, is in the time of Noah, where God said that the imagination of people's hearts was only evil, always evil. And following that is the phrase that the earth was filled with violence. And so the idea is that evil thoughts led to evil deeds which were violent in nature. And we think of people being killed and all sorts of things like that when we see ideas and thoughts linked together that way. But interestingly, when Jesus picked up this note in the New Testament, he said, what was it like in the days of Noah? Well, people ate, they drank, they married, and they gave in marriage. Well, just ask yourself the question then, what's violent about getting married? What's violent about going to a wedding? What's violent about sitting down to a meal? Because Jesus didn't say gluttony or any of those other words which he used on numerous occasions. Jesus was talking about normal human pastimes. And so what Jesus indicated was that those people had destroyed the order which God had set in place. The violence was directed against God's order. They had no time for God. They wanted to fill their faces and enjoy themselves. They had no time for God. That was the violent act in Genesis. Is it? Or am I overstating things? In the 8th chapter of Ezekiel, 17th verse, we have these words. Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? Now, what's been going on here is that Ezekiel is a priest. He's in Babylon. He's been deported to Babylon by Babylonian invaders. And he's looking back at the temple in Jerusalem and delivering this polemic against the temple. Now, the temple had, from the time of Solomon, had gradually become more and more desecrated, shall we say. And when you look at what's going on here in Ezekiel and some of the other references in Jeremiah talking about approximately the same time, it's quite probable that there were as many as five different religions represented in the temple at that time. We have at least three of them here in this chapter, the 8th chapter. In other words, God's house, God's temple, was being used for a lot of more things and merely worshipping God. In the verse immediately preceding, you can see that people were worshipping the rising sun in the temple. Those are the abominations that Ezekiel is talking about there in that 17th verse. The thought that gradually over time, the Jewish people had brought many different profane gods into the temple, which should be reserved exclusively for their God Yahweh. Is it a light thing that they commit these abominations, as many as possibly up to five different deities there in the temple, in addition to the items for the worship of God? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their nose. Isn't that an interesting little phrase? What does it mean? You put a branch to your nose. It's fascinating that this word, which is translated nose, occurs about 270 times in the Old Testament. 171 of those occasions, the word is translated anger. And in 22 other times, the word is translated wrath. And then we have a few other words like envy and so on, which are thrown in for good measure, even though the word really does mean nose. So around a quarter, maybe a little more than a quarter of those occurrences, the word is actually translated nose or nostrils. Sometimes it's translated countenance. So how do you get from the idea of a nose to the idea of anger? Well, can you think of somebody being so mad that their nostrils are flaring? Can you think of the changing the appearance of their face and it's showing even in the nose as it happens? We see that. We experience that sometimes. Can you think of these snorts of derision and disgust which come out of our noses sometimes when we disapprove of something? Can you think of the English phrases, he turned up their nose at them, snubbed their noses at them, and things like that? Can you think of these ways some people use their nose? You know, they twitch it and don't like that. So what Ezekiel is saying here is that these people not only turn their back on God, as it said in the previous verse, worshipped all kinds of other things in place of God, right in God's house, but they also turn their back up, turn their noses up at the presence of God. And it's there in many ways and in different figurative language. So where's the violence? Now we know beyond doubt, in the time of Jesus and shortly before and shortly after, that Jews from all around the world willingly delivered their temple tax to the temple. There was no need for the priest to go out and collect it. It came in. There's every indication that that practice was going on in the time of Ezekiel, that the Jews were quite willing to support the temple. It was their house. It was the center of their society. But what had happened as they did that? You see, if you're going to do that, you don't do things the way they have been set up in under Moses, where there was a portion of your agricultural product which went to support the temple. You now had to get into a monetary system. Now, the nice thing about a fixed tax in an agricultural situation is that in a good year, everybody has lots and the temple gets a good share. In a bad year, the temple gets a much smaller year, and the goodness and the pain is spread throughout society. But when you come into a monetary system, you now start to find the temple acting as the central banker. You now have to send your money regardless of whether you've made it in your farm or not. The tax hasn't changed. It's a set figure, and you send it. We know that at the time of Christ that the priests were engaged in the mortgage business. Many people lost their land to avaricious priests who insisted on the mortgage and the interest being paid. And that practice seems to be starting here. The evidence is not quite so good here, but we know definitely that from the time of the Maccabees on, that practice was rampant. Money was running the system. And with it went the honor system of Moses, With it went the equitable nature of the tax system under Moses, and with it went the suppression of the people for whom the temple was the center of their world. That was part of the violence that we speak of here. 23rd verse of the previous chapter points out two things. It says that there was a lot of blood spilt in the land, and the city was full of violence. Now, the other thing which was going on at this time was that the Babylonians had taken this Jewish homeland in as part of their empire. Every couple of years or so, a large contingent of the Babylonian army would come through the whole of the empire and pick up taxes and so forth. And those people were not particularly kind. Violence certainly was a way of life with them. But what is made quite clear when we look at the rest of Ezekiel is that that happened because the priests lost their way and the people had all kinds of other gods, and so God gave them to the Babylonians. What they had done brought about their fate. And that's what James says, isn't it? You set the tone of your life by the way you live your life. We find it here. And the violence is against God's order. It's interesting that, yes, the word is used of violent acts. It's used of people being killed. It's used of people being damaged in a number of different ways. But it's also used that way. And that idea is very much a part of Bible teaching. We can violate God's way. And when we do, we destroy the society that we're part of. And as we do that, all sorts of conflicts arise. All sorts of things happen that we can't really get rid of and we can't stop once they start. But is it human nature? Is it the fact that we want something? Is it the fact that we think you should do something differently? Are the human thoughts which are driving these conflagrations, these wars, these disputes, loss of people's houses and so forth? Or is it what the Bible teaches? I would suggest to you that if we follow the teachings of the Bible, it will be very different. Remember Jesus as the first example of passive resistance. The first century Christians got trouble from everywhere. They didn't side with the Jews against the Romans. They wouldn't side with the Romans because the Romans believed their Caesar to be divine. They were caught in the middle of this war because they were pacifists. So is it Christianity that causes problems in the world? Or is it people? Wherever you go, and whatever they choose to do.